This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Before Annie Clark, professionally known as St. Vincent, was traveling the country playing to crowds in the thousands, she gave stripped-down performances to small groups of music fans in a certain record store. That store wasn't just any record shop. It was the legendary Other Music, a staple of the music scene since the 1990s and the early stomping grounds for other once up-and-coming bands like Vampire Weekend, Regina Spektor, The National, Anima Collective, and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. It was founded right across the street from a Tower Records by a group of guys who were interested in, as the name suggests, other music, the kind of things you weren't likely to find in the big-name brand stores, and curated by a passionate music-loving staff. Other Music closed in 2016. It was sort of sudden, but not all that surprising given the impact streaming platforms have had on all record stores and on in-person music shopping in general. But now Other Music is memorialized in a film that bears the store's name and played at the Tribeca Film Festival last spring. The film was supposed to screen at the IFC Center this week in celebration of Record Store Day on April 18th, now postponed to June 20th, but the filmmakers are now teaming up with record stores and indie cinemas around the country for a virtual release tomorrow. The film will be available via Factory 25/Oscilloscope from April 17th to the 20th, with 50% of the proceeds benefiting select independent cinemas and record stores in the U.S. I spoke with filmmakers Paloma Basu and Rob Hatch Miller about Other Music last spring. I began by asking Paloma when they started working on the documentary. Let's listen.
The day that Other Music announced that they were closing, we found out just like everyone else on Twitter. And, you know, we were crushed. And we both found ourselves at the store that night, and we saw everything that was going on. It was such a charged atmosphere that we just kind of, like, started talking like someone needs to do something. And, you know, time passed, like, a few days passed, and we realized, like, well, no one else is going to do it other than us. So, yeah, we started working on it right away, and we filmed every day for the last 6 weeks that they were in business.
Now, you guys, Rob, you guys had worked at Other Music. When was that?
I worked at Other Music starting as a sophomore at NYU Film School back in 2002. And Paloma never worked at the store, but she was a longtime customer, had a lot of relationships with people there, and we actually met each other and got married because of our mutual friend, Dwayne Harriet, who worked at the store and is now a DJ on WFMU in New Jersey.
So the store has layers of meaning for the two of you. As a filmmaker, what is it about this story that is riveting, about the Other Music story?
I think for us it was a number of things. One, that the store was such an epicenter of the music scene in New York during a time that people are now very nostalgic for. We keep getting asked about just how New York has changed and it's not the same as it used to be. And I have to think back on, like, moving to New York as an 18-year-old in the year 2000. I read the Legs McNeil Oral History of Punk, Please Kill Me. And I remember walking down St. Mark's Place and just thinking, oh, New York sucks now. It's not what it was back in 1977. And little did I know that 3 years later, I'd find myself working at this store that was, you know, showing the world and the city, like, all these amazing artists that now people hold in just as high esteem, almost. We wanted to make sure that their contribution to the music history of New York and indie music in general was remembered, because this is a place that impacted our lives and so many people's lives, and we just thought, if we don't tell this story, then once the store closes, it'll just be, you know, some articles on Pitchfork. You search for them online,
it'll become myth as opposed to you actually documenting what happened and how it all started. So, Paloma, how did it all start? I described it as two guys who wanted to start a music store. It's a little bit more than that.
Yeah, so it was actually Chris Vanderloo and Josh Maydell and Jeff Gibson, and the three of them actually worked at Kim's Video. They were in the record store in the back of the video rental store, and, you know, they didn't have very much freedom to order what they wanted to, and they knew that there were a lot of people in the city that were, like, yearning for the sort of stuff that they wanted to put out, you know, to bring to people. So they started talking about it, and, you know, they decided to leave Kim's and start Other Music. And it happened very fast for them.
And you mentioned John Gibson. He's the one person of the three founders who doesn't appear in the film. Is that he didn't want to, or he's just moved on? What's going on?
He moved to Belgium And basically, he left the store and he moved and kind of lost touch with everybody. And we tried to find him. You know, we tried to reach him in a bunch of different ways, like even through his son's little league baseball team in Belgium. But, you know, it didn't work out. So he never actually said no. He just, you know, we just couldn't find him.
How did the store, Rob, how did they pick that location right across from Tower Records?
Well, Chris Vanderloo, one of the co-founders, always says that he thought that was just a great walking block going from the east to west side or west to east side of Manhattan. And it was a place where there were other music stores. And they felt that if they opened right across the street from the biggest record store downtown that, and they were offering the kind of music that you couldn't get in that store, that they would naturally get people sent over there. If somebody went into Tower Records and said, do you have the new, probably at the time, like Pavement CD mm-hmm. or something, which Tower might not have been carrying Matador Records back in 1995, 1996, then they would go across the street to other music, and it just exploded. They were a store that sold thousands of copies of the big albums of that era, like Bell and Sebastian, If You're Feeling Sinister, was something that was available only on import and only at other music initially when it came out. That was the place where you had to go to get it in New York City, and you can imagine what a giant album that became by the time it was released domestically. So they just really did a ton of business, and they really influenced the way that NYU students were buying music, and just downtown Manhattan was a different place at the time. There were other musicians living nearby. It was a
there were clubs.
Arts hub. There were clubs.
Brownies.
There's still a few. You know, Mercury Lounge is still hung on, but you know, as things moved onto the internet and out to Brooklyn and the outer boroughs, things just kind of dissipated from there.
My guests are Paloma Basu and Rob Hatch Miller. We're talking about their new documentary, Other Music, which is screening at the Montclair Film Festival and the Tribeca Film Festival. That is so interesting about that relationship between Tower Records, that it didn't turn out to be adversarial. It turned out to be sort of symbiotic in a way.
Yeah, well, they say in the film that, you know, some people that would come in just thought that they were insane. Like, I think Chris says, like, somebody came in and said, have you guys looked out your window? But it was a genius plan in the end, and they outlasted Tower Records by a good number of years. Tower closed in 2006, I believe.
Yeah, 2007 maybe, yeah.
Still a good, at least 9 years earlier.
Yeah.
So the two owners who were in the film, can you describe what each of them, Paloma, what each of them brought to the ethos of Other Music?
Well, you know, let's see. Jeff Gibson was, you know, really into esoteric music. And, you know, he was really focused on bringing things into the store that you just couldn't find anywhere in the country at the time. So, you know, that was his thing. He was actually the one who gave it the name Other Music.
And he would bring in things like Os Mutantes and Serge Gainsbourg as imports before they were available domestically or really sold anywhere. And they kind of, you know, really blew up at the time.
Yeah, and then Chris Vanderloo, I mean, they're all just obsessed with music. Chris Vanderloo was very much, like, people-oriented. Mm-hmm. So he kind of, like, really took care of customers, and he took care of the business side of things. And Josh was, you know, very much, like, into, like, doing things for the community. So, you know, planning all the in-stores, like putting on events, figuring out how to serve the community, bring music to people constantly, putting out anything that, you know, they had a little label for themselves for a while, and, you know, they would find artists that no one else wanted to put out, and they would put them out, and yeah.
It's interesting, the employees and the salespeople, I think of them more, especially after, I mean, I've been in Other Music many times, but after watching the film, I really thought of them more like curators, that they really had a sense of what they wanted to bring to the store, of the vibe they wanted the store to have, the way the music should be presented and categorized. What was the influence of the employees, Rob?
Well, the store really leaned on its employees. You know, they helped buy records to stock on the shelves, and each different employee had kind of a different area of expertise. Like, a lot of people who went into the store would probably recognize Scott Mao, who's a very tall, lanky, long-haired, beautiful Asian man, so super funny, mm-hmm. So personable, just charmed everyone. He's just an expert on techno music and dance music. And Dwayne Harriet, who worked there for a long time, is sort of a jack of all trades. I mean, he knows everything from reggae to disco to soul to psychedelic rock to, you know, glam rock and power pop and everything. He just loves everything from indie rock to God knows what else.
And Dwayne did build the hip hop section at the store.
They didn't have one before he started, so he was the one who sort of just started figuring out what the other music version of independent underground hip hop would be. Michael Klossman, who worked there for a long time, was also kind of a specialist in reissues. He helped bring in a lot of the sort of quote unquote freak folk stuff that blew up in around 2004 from like Devendra Banhart and reissues of people like Vashti Bunyan, Jackson C. Frank, people like Joanna Newsom, who we sold very early on. And there's even more people than that. I mean, all the way to the end, some of the customers, some of the employees that we got to know those last few years, you know, like Stephanie Arentes, who's now a manager of sort of like Latin experimental groups, was bringing in all kinds of interesting like stuff from South America that nobody was talking about or carrying anywhere else. So they really made the employees more than just, you know, clerks running a cash register.
And that was a big part of the unique experience, that it was a unique experience every time you went into the store, which is one of the things that was sort of magical about it. My guests are Paloma Basu and Rob Hatch Miller. We're talking about their new film, Other Music, about the Venerable Music Store, Record Store, Other Music, that was in the East Village. So the documentary has lots of impressive names. People would know Ezra Koenig from Vampire Weekend, Regina Spektor. A customer comes in named Benicio del Toro. Was that interview planned or did he just stroll in?
Oh, no, he just walked right in. And
I always knew he was cool.
And, you know, that was actually really nerve-wracking for me because it was the first day I was filming and I was still learning. It was a new camera, so I was still learning the camera. And when I saw him, I was like, oh, God. Like, of course, you know.
An Academy Award winner strolls into the cool record store.
Yeah, but he was great. He was so nice and was really good to me.
He seemed into it. He seemed really sort of pleased to be a part of the project.
Well, he'd been a customer going back way back when I worked there 2002 to 2005, he was coming in and he would just literally ask the clerks to give him a stack of CDs to check out. And he would come back in a month later and just want to talk about how much he loved certain things. He'd come back and bring gifts for the people who gave him CDs that he loved. He was just such a huge music fan and kind of a member of that community for years.
How did you decide who you wanted to interview? He was a surprise interview, but when you really sat down and thought, who do we need to talk to tell this story?
Well, we did want to, you know, we wanted to interview a lot of people who kind of got their start at Other Music, you know, people that would bring in demos of their CDs that they would burn themselves, you know, before they were signed or anything like that. So, like, we always wanted to interview the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. And, of course, Animal Collective worked at the store. So, you know, we definitely knew we had to get them. Who else?
Other people like Jason Schwartzman, like Benicio del Toro, was just a fixture at the store. Whenever he would come to New York, he would come hang out for hours, just talk to everybody, want to talk about music. And he was somebody who was devastated, you know, emailed a really sweet letter to the owners of the store when it closed. So we wanted to make sure he was included. Mm-hmm. He gives a lot of great comic relief in the film. There was so much great stuff in his interview that we weren't even able to include.
And you know, other bands like The National, like Matt Berninger was also like starting out before his band was a thing. He would go to Other Music, he said, almost every day, and he would just like spend so much money there.
Yeah, when we were in post-production on the movie, this really, really great oral history of the early 2000s music scene came out called Meet Me in the Bathroom by a writer named Lizzie Goodman. Obviously that book was talking a lot about things that were parallel to our story. So I read it and I knew that we had to interview Lizzie because she's the expert on that topic right now. And as I was reading the book, I can't remember what chapter I was going through, but there's a part where Matt Berninger talks about Other Music and how important it was to him as an NYU student and a New Yorker. Just it was a place for him to go and discover new music. So we thought we should ask him. And luckily, since we've moved to LA, we had access to a lot of people like him and Tunde Adebimpe from TV on the Radio who have also switched coasts.
We did have one kind of like, you know, someone we would have, of course, always loved to have in the film, Martin Gore from Depeche Mode. But the way we got him was kind of crazy. We were running a Kickstarter campaign for the documentary. And like at the end of the campaign, we were packing up the rewards and sending them off. And, you know, we printed out these labels. And I was like, huh, this person's name is Martin Gore. and I was like, do you think it's the Martin Gore?
Yeah, I said, well, I know he chopped at the store, so maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, and so then, but it was like, you know, a California address, and Rob was like, there's no way he lives here. And then we looked it up online, and of course he did. And so we emailed him because we had his email because he, you know,
signed the pledged. Kickstarter. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he wrote back to us right away. And like, before we knew it, we were at his house, like in his studio.
With our baby.
That's a great story. Let's take a listen to Ezra Koenig. He's talking about his experience at Other Music.
Growing up going to Other Music, I literally discovered genres because of the way they would organize the music. You know, you'd go to Tower Records across the street and you might go to like the world section. Like the world section, you always find like African stuff, it always be Celtic stuff. You know, it's all like this kind of big, like very broad way of organizing like these forms of music. Whereas Other Music had these like kind of more specific, sometimes by when something came out, these more specific ways of dividing up music. You know, you couldn't just find anything from the 60s. You had like Other Music's vision of what was important from the 60s. So to even remotely be connected to Other Music's vision of what was important in 2007 was, you know, very meaningful to me.
It was also great in the film you talk about how important those handwritten cards were, the dividers. Can you explain to our listeners what I'm talking about and why they were so important?
Well, you know, the store was big on reviewing music. They had an email newsletter that started in 1999 where employees of the store and some hired freelancers would write about music. And they would write about it not from like, hey, we're trying to like push these records and sell them. It was really more of a celebration of like things that the staff members loved. Yes, I think the incentive was like, we want to sell copies mm-hmm. of this, but it wasn't like, you have to write about this whether you like it or not. So that also, you know, took the form of handwritten cards for more limited releases that they couldn't carry in high enough quantities to sell hundreds of copies through their website. So, you know, if a staff member really liked something, they came in and there was a couple copies of it, they would just, you know, put it on the stereo, and while they're walking around helping customers, maybe write out a couple sentences about it, put some tape on the back, maybe, you know, cut some cool images out of like a flyer from the foyer mm-hmm. of the store and slap it up on the shelf. So there were just boxes full of them going back years and years and years in the back of the store, among all the things that we found, including boxes of the VHS tapes of the in-stores that are in the film. And
they're great. There's like Regina Spektor. There's a whole bunch of them. They're really fun to watch.
Yeah, I think the most mind-blowing for us is Neutral Milk Hotel. Jeff Mangum was a customer of the store for a long time. He's somebody who's not huge on appearing on camera. When Neutral Milk Hotel did their reunion tour, they were sort of notoriously kind of anti-cell phone camera. He deleted anything that got posted on YouTube. So we watched this tape of Jeff Mangum performing at the store in 1996 before their very popular landmark album In the Aeroplane Over the Sea came out. And the set starts with an acoustic performance of maybe one of their best known songs, Two-Headed Boy. It's the first known recording of the song anywhere, and it's just beautiful. We watched that tape and our minds were just blown. So we knew we have to get this in the film. And luckily, Jeff was very excited to be included in the film and said he was honored to be part of the story. So we're very lucky to have that in the film. It's kind of like the center point of the film for me.
The film obviously deals with the closing of the store. It was really rather sudden. And there's a lot of discussion in the film about the world of streaming and digital music versus sort of the analog, hands-on part of it. And I'm just curious, for a last question, is do you think it's nostalgia? Are we all just having nostalgia for it? Or was something really lost? I mean, there's so many ways people can get their music out now that they never could before. All kinds of bands, new bands, unsigned bands. So in some ways, it's an amazing thing. Are we being too nostalgic, or was something really lost, or both?
We love streaming music. I mean, I think it's great that people have access to things. I think it's great that when people pay to have access to things. But it's really cool that, like, young kids now have, if they want to, they can hear anything in a way that we couldn't in the 90s and 2000s. You know, you had to spend money and invest, not just your time to find out about things that weren't mainstream. Streaming music is a great thing, but at the same time, I think you do need these community centers where you can connect with other human beings on a you know, face-to-face level, and those places are going away as things move more and more online, and you can't just have restaurants and coffee shops and gyms be the only place where you might meet somebody and have a conversation. Yeah. So there's something really important about that in a retail environment that's, you know, not just like a shoe store or a clothing store. I think video stores, even if they're not completely necessary, if you can get stuff on iTunes or Netflix or whatever, it's great to be able to go to a video store, even if you just go once a month and check out what's on the shelf and maybe come across something that doesn't show up in your recommended list on Amazon Prime, and maybe the clerk there will tell you about something that you'll really love. And that's a good thing. Yeah.
The name of the documentary is Other Music. Rob and Paloma, thank you so much for joining us on all of it.
Thank you so much.